How do we cultivate patience? What to do when we sense or know people are projecting on us? How to change habits? Well, Swamiji answered this kind of how to cultivate patience in kind of a, it was a little different question, but it was similar. And so I'll answer it in the same way because I liked his answer, actually. I think it's true. Like, how to cultivate patience is to be patient. Sounds silly, actually, but that is how you cultivate patience. How to cultivate kindness is to be kind. And that means that you have to be, have kind of make a sankalpa, like a resolve, and do kind of an auto-suggestion, you know, that when you can see in your life where you have a tendency to be impatient, or you have a tendency to be mean or, you know, irritable, in those you can make a sankalpa, like in this situation, you know, I'm going to be patient. When this happens, I'm going to practice patience. So that you have a little space between that sankalpa gives you, that auto-suggestion gives you a little space between just acting out immediately in your irritable way, you know, your kind of unkind way. It gives you space to kind of remember that sankalpa and that value. You can do that. But then it can just be, you know, like a daily practice until it becomes natural. And it's very rewarding also. And so it doesn't take that long for it to become natural because it's so rewarding in terms of your shanti and other people's trust in you because they know you're not going to fly off the handle. And kindness is the same. They know you're not going to be mean or cruel, you know, because whatever parts of you that have that tendency, you've worked on it till it's not something that comes up anymore, but sometimes you have to work on it because you can be irritable or harsh in certain circumstances. And then you have to zero in on those circumstances. At where to begin the practice is there, in reference to those circumstances where you tend to be irritable or unkind. Because it's normal for us to be patient, but there's situations where we're not. It's normal for us to be kind, but there's situations where we're not, and there's not that many. So you have to zero in on the ones where that rises up in you, you know, and then make an auto suggestion like the next time that happens, you need to be kind. Or a good thing is to visualize it also. Say you do say you become very irritable in that given situation, then you reimagine that situation the way you'd like to be in that situation, and that sends that message. Your unconscious, and it has another way to behave, otherwise just unconsciously behaves in the good old way that you've become accustomed to. So those ways of working with ourselves are really, really helpful. How to change habits. First of all, it's the same thing. First of all, you have to realize that you would really seriously like to change the habit, because it's not going to change itself. You know, it's a habit. So you have to realize that habit is not something that you want. And so then you can do the same thing. You can visualize. First, you have this habit. Visualize how you would like to be instead of in the situation where that habit arises, you know, you visualize yourself and how you would like to be, you know. And that's very helpful. It's an auto-suggestion. It's just speaking in the language of the psyche, you know, which has to do with emotion and images and things like that. So that revisualization is just a way of saying it in words, but in a way that the psyche is more powerful for the psyche. Hi. Please talk about how you experience moksha. How is your experience of life different after and before self-knowledge? Moksha is sometimes called happiness that has no reason, that doesn't come and go. I can feel for myself, for the level of clarity I have now, that there is more peace and comfort and trust on a deep level, but I don't know about happiness. How do you experience that happiness or love? Maybe I'm just mixing up a state of mind with moksha. It's hard to know what expectations to have. Yeah. These happiness and love and all of these words are words that we really use a lot in reference to vritti, like I'm happy, that makes me so happy. And so we can't apply that to the nature of the self. The self certainly is not unhappy, but the word happiness doesn't quite capture your own nature either, because then you would just say, oh, I'm really happy all the time. and that word just lands more on a state of experience than on the ongoing, than your own ongoing presence. So it's not that it's the negative of any of these, but your own nature is just very, very, very strong and whole and complete and who you naturally are without any impediments, without any limitations, because nothing else you want it to be. You don't want to be any other way. The way who you are, the way you are, what your nature is exactly what you want, and you can't imagine a way to improve it. There's nothing else that you want. And so it's not a state of experience like the word happiness implies, but it's a fullness or a completeness or that which we call the most, that which is most dear. And then when you say, well, what do you mean by the most dear? Well, you want it to be there forever and you never want it to change in any way, you know. So in that way, like, I want that to always be. This is who I am. I want it to always be. And then you also know it always will be. And this is now still getting into moksha. The mind is the one that had self-ignorance. And as it, when it gained self-knowledge, really that self-knowledge is what which allows the self that I am to be differentiated from all of the experiences that come and go, that I identify with, like all of the moods, all of the emotions, all of the relationships, all of the vrittis, you know, the body itself. I identify all of that with myself. And so those, all of those identifications, body, mind, sense organs, vrittis, emotions, etc., create a pratibandhika. They put a limitation on my being because I'm seeing myself through the limitations of that particular upadhi, you know, which is continually changing. But when that, as that knowledge becomes clear, then the body, mind, sense organs also don't really, they stop placing a limitation on you for two reasons. First of all, your being is changeless and never limited by anything. So it doesn't really matter what the thoughts or feelings are, what the experiences are, because those are, belong to Maya. They belong to the creation, and they don't cover you. They belong to your body, they belong to your mind, but they don't There's no adyasa, the superimposition there. So you are as you are, and then you have these thoughts and emotions and feelings and perceptions and all that, but all part of Ishvara. But say as you gain knowledge and your mind realizes that everything at once is really the very nature of the self, then it loses its vairagya, completes itself in the ananda that it was always seeking for. You gain as a mumuksha, you gain vairagya, that dispassion, you know, for the world, because that viveka, that discrimination is there, and you realize that none of this can give you anything that's lasting. And so even if it's really a happy experience, it's finite, it's time-bound. But now, when you gain knowledge, that's not the experience. Because the self is not time-bound. And it's not distant either. It is you. And so the mind can relax, knowing that what it has always wanted will never go away. Swamiji used to say, and even Ishwara can't take it away. Because it's also Ishwara's adhishtana, Ishwara's own being, too. So the Maya can't touch it in any way. And so your mind gets to have that stable me that really is the most beloved, what you most love. And you recognize that there's no time for you. It's not as though you will grow old, or that you will die, or that you even had a birth and that you're subject to any kind of change. That's all over with. And so the mind has much more natural relaxation and shanti, because it's not trying to find its way so that I can be happy. I need this and I need to do that and I have to find my security. You know, what do we really need? You know, to protect ourselves so that we can be happy and all of this kind of thing that are very real concerns. For jnani, those concerns aren't there much at all. And then that gets into, they're not there much because of Ishvara. You know, the prarabdha is the prarabdha. Swamiji used to say, you know, like, if it's not in your prarabdha, then you won't get it. So don't worry about it. But if it is in your prarabdha, you'll get it. So don't worry about it. So what if I just have that shraddha? A lot of that shraddha comes just through life experience in light of your knowledge. What if you just enjoy being with what is, and letting the karma, the prarabdha karma that's caused you to take this birth and growth takes you all the way through the life. You see that as Ishvara. And let's see what unfolds. And let's see what Bhagavan does. It's infinite intelligence. Yours is limited intelligence. So Ishvara is myself's infinite intelligence. And this body, mind, sense organs is very limited in intelligence, you know, in relationship. And so what if this one who has limited intelligence enjoys seeing what your limitless intelligence, how they're going to handle these situations, which are complex. Oh, look at how complex the world situation is. Look, our situation, each individual situation, is quite complex. There's many, many threads coming into your life from many directions, you know. So what if you enjoy watching Bhagavan unfold, watching the prarabdha karma unfold, where you do your dharma, whatever is right for you to do every given moment, and then don't think too much about the future. You can think about the future, but the problem is we think, you know, we really have to plan for the future. You know, that's fine if the planning for the future is something that is taking place in the present. These things have to be done now in terms of what we're doing. But you can worry about and plan for a future that is just imaginal, you know. So if there's something that you can do now for this imaginal future, then that's practical. But otherwise, you're living in an imaginal future that there's nothing to do about it except worry. Like, is this imaginal future, is it going to happen or is it not going to happen? What if it doesn't happen? Then what will happen to me? Because I need that imaginal future to be happy. You know? What if it doesn't happen? Mind starts spinning all kinds of things. So what I suggest, and what I suggested because it actually really worked well for me, when your mind spins out like that, you know, just bring it home. Which starts, you know, it's out into this la-la land, which is can be fine and fun, until it starts creating doubts and worries and angst, you know, and unhappiness, then it's good to come home. You know, let Bhagwan and take care of that. We're going to do what needs to be done here and now. That way you get to, life becomes very, very simple, and also your emotions become much more handleable. Because they're here and now, in the present. You're not something that has been constructed by your imagination. So I think that all really helps. A jnani tends to stay much more in the present and doesn't worry so much about knowing what we're going to be doing in 3 or 4 months or what decisions we're going to be making at that time, because it's too early to know that. You know? I wonder what we're going to do. We have no way to know what we're going to do. You have to wait for a few months. When it's closer to the time of what you're going to do, then you can make a decision. Yeah, when you say happiness, moksha is sometimes called happiness that has no reason, that doesn't come and go. Yeah, I would say instead of happiness, so that's a good enough word, that state of well-being, you know, all is well with me. You know, doesn't come and go, because the self doesn't come and go. In fact, that's going to be there even if thoughts and emotions are flying through. That's the constant, kind of the constant, what we call bhava, of your own being. Yeah, there's more peace and comfort and trust on a deep level. But how do you experience that happiness, love? Because when you use the word happiness and love, you're talking about a vritti, an actual experience. So now what you have to do is say, why does the Shastra call this ananda or happiness or love, the self? What? Because that has to be here right now. You know. So you have to say, why are these kind of words like ananda or love or well-being? These are all, they're called lakshanas, words that are pointing to, you know, they're pointing to something for you to understand, but it's not contained in the word as defined in the world, but there's some resonance that resonates, the meaning of that word resonates with your own being, even though the nature of yourself is different. And so you take these words that you know their meaning within duality, and then you say, why does the Shastra say that I am Ananda, or I am the most loved? What is that referring to? What is that about myself that deserves this lakshana? And then you just have to sit with yourself and until you recognize that, and you go, oh, it's a good recognition. It's true. There's nothing more dear. If you were asked by a child what Ishwara is, what would you say? I'd probably have to have a child ask me, and then I'd see what I would say. Let me see if I can imagine. If they knew what the word Ishwara was, they would say, why don't you tell me what you think? What do you think Ishwara is? Because I would have some idea. And then I would probably be with that conversation for a while. It'd be so sweet to see what they say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you could both have a beautiful conversation around it, but they could start it and add to it. I would like to have that conversation. What is the difference between Sahaja Samadhi and Moksha? Moksha is really removing that ajnanam, having self-knowledge, and then Sahaja Samadhi. Sahaja means natural. And so say we say, what is that? What is the natural, that natural Samadhi? I think maybe, I mean, there's probably different ways to talk about it, but for ajnani, and what it really means to have self-knowledge is that you've recognized yourself, which is always, never not present. It doesn't matter at all what the vritti is, what the thought is, what the experience is. It doesn't make any difference because it doesn't in any way cover yourself. And so the mind, you could kind of say like the buddhi, kind of being rooted in yourself means enjoying its own being. You know, like sometimes I say just gently focus on yourself. And what I mean when I say in meditation, like gently focus on yourself, means don't worry about there being other thoughts or other perceptions, or it doesn't make any difference. It's not covering you at all. So it's like kind of just put one foot in, get one foot in and one foot out. Let the mind enjoy, let the buddhi just enjoying yourself experience the world. And after a time you don't even have to think about that because that kind of is what's happening anyway. You know, it's not like your buddhi is in any way removed or separate from yourself. There's no separation there at all, just because satya mitya, that, you know, where does the pot have to go to have an experience of the clay? It doesn't have to go anywhere. Really, the me, myself, is ever present. It just hasn't been differentiated. So once it's differentiated, then I am always in samadhi. The samadhi is myself, you know, and the buddhi is not away from the self. The thoughts are not away from the self. The emotions are not away from the self. No perceptions are away from the self. So what about when that's recognized? Then you don't really need your mind to be in any special way, because whatever the mind is doing, it's not away from yourself. And yourself is, you know, swatha siddha. It's self-evidence, aparoksha. You are self-evident. You don't require the mind to be in a particular way. You don't have to require it to be focused on you. You don't need the buddhi focused on you to be you. You're really the consciousness itself that illumines the buddhi. We do that as an exercise because the buddhi is, and the whole upadis are so used to taking the self to be, themselves to be the self, that what we call mutual superimposition is completely cast, it's completely there, very, very strongly there. You know? So the buddhi has to, for a while, break that habit of complete identification. And it does that, it's what we call nididhyasana, it does that by coming into relationship with its own being. It realizes that it itself is illumined. All of the vrittis are illumined. And it differentiates itself from me, the luminary. And I'm the stable one, I'm never changing in any way. And the buddhi and the manas and all the upadis, they're always continually changing, as is the world. But once you recognize all that, once that's really known, then does the mind have to be in a particular way, you know, to be with the self? Does your mind have to be a particular way to be with yourself? And we say it can be in any way that it is. Because it's mitya. It's mitya. And so the only thing that is really there is me. And what is mitya never really covers me in any way. It can be a vritti you don't like, or an emotion you don't like. But then you don't have much investment in those emotions. To say, oh, I don't like this emotion. They don't really care. You know, it's an emotion. Maybe there's a reason for that emotion, you know. to be more inclined to work with that emotion and see why that emotion's even coming in the first place. If it's, you know, a painful emotion, why is that there? It's like, say you have a friend or there's somebody in your group, in your sangha, whatever, who's, you know, having an emotion. You know, then you would want to know what's going on or what's happening. You know, how can I help? That's how we have to be toward our own emotions. You know, what is this? What's happening? What's going on? You can, just like you would help a person externally, help internally. But it doesn't cover you. You know, and so that sahaja samadhi is just that yourself is well known. There's no jnana there. So you don't have to protect yourself. And the mind relishes. Like in the Bhagavad Gita, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, it's just, you know, the mind, you know, becomes your best friend. It's no longer your enemy, you're its best friend. And it revels in being with you. It says it all through the Gita. It's like the mind is in love with you because you're the beloved. So that's sahaja samadhi. You don't have to do anything about it. It's like saying you don't have to do anything about yourself because it's timeless. It's free from any type of change. Nothing can be done about it, so you can relax. You can't hurt it. There's two great things. One really great thing, especially for Westerners, you can't improve it. Now, if you can improve it, then all us go-getters, you know, are going to always be working to improve it. So that's a problem. The other problem is you might be able to make it worse. That's also a problem. But when you can't do anything, and it already is whole and complete, and you can't botch it up, that's a tremendous, wonderful, relaxing freedom. And that's all part of the sahaja samadhi. We don't use that term too much. It's there in the second half of Driktrisha Viveka. We talk about it. Otherwise, it's not a term that comes up all the time, but it is. It does exist. Oh, this is a cute little envelope. Dear Radha, the vision of Vedanta about the self, the creation, and the universe, and knowledge, is knowledge and not a belief. How does it match with quantum physics and the scientific discoveries and theories of creation and existence? Einstein's theory of relative time and unity with space. The position of the whole Shastra, the Vedas and the Upanishads, is that there is no, what do you call, conflict with all of the laws that we can continue to uncover within the creation. I mean, that as human beings, with the means of knowledge that we have, we can continue to explore and to learn about, especially science and math and biology and psychology and physiology and astronomy and astrology, all of these things, we go on. But some people wouldn't include astrology, but anyway. we go on uncovering all of this, and we call that uncovering is the removal, that removing of ignorance, really, about all of the laws and the relationships that are there in the creation. And so there's no conflict there. We don't have any conflict with the infinite, the Swamiji would say, the infinite orders that are there in the creation, like the mathematical order, which itself is so fascinating and so deep. I mean, we can just scratch into the surface of all of these things, you know, astronomy and all of these type of orders. There's no, even whether it's quantum physics, that's another order. It's just going into another level. You know, it's fascinating. There's no conflict there. We're talking about the Adhishtana, you know, and the nature of reality, whether it's the quantum physics or on this level or whatever level we're on, it's still what is the nature of its the reality, and it will fall within mithya, which is no insult. That's not an insult that something falls within the category of mithya. It's just the nature of everything in the creation that's subject to time. It falls into that category, no matter how elegant, you know, it is. So we can go on as individuals within the creation, we can go on discovering more and more about it and making use of it, and there's no conflict at all. Quantum physics has its use, and as you start to understand it, you understand more about it and more about it, and the way that we operationalize all that knowledge to be beneficial to us. But there's no way that it's going to touch or negate Vedanta, because it's in a way apples and oranges. For science has to do, we have sense organs in a mind, we have means of knowledge to take science to whatever level is humanly possible in terms of the collecting of our understanding and knowledge. But the Atma yourself is not an object of knowledge within the time and space creation, you know. So we're not going to be able to explore the self with our sense organs in the same way. A knowledge of the self is gained much differently. And then knowledge of the whole universe in relation to the self requires the shastra. Because in science we can get down to it's a millionth of a second before the Big Bang. But we have to be on this side of it, not on this side of it. Be on this side of it, there's no one there to know that. There's no subject-object relationship to know that, you know. And so science, when actually some scientists, I forget the name of the Indian man, but then there's Fritjof Kotba and some other people in science and cosmology. When they study Vedanta, then it really makes sense to them, you know, because they've gotten so close to that point that they can't go beyond, you know. But they also see kind of the infinite order, the infinite intelligence, not as like some god in heaven, but at the infinite order and the expression of this creation. And so a lot of some physicists are trying to make those links, because because it works to see it. So some people are doing all that. But the Vedanta doesn't have any problem with the knowledge that we can legitimately gain, this is important, what we can legitimately know through the means of knowledge we have available to us. If you go beyond the means of knowledge that we have available, then it becomes some kind of imagination. You know, like, say if a philosopher is having an imagining, you know, how the universe came into being and how this happened and that happened, how the humans came, and they're just using their imagination, then that's not really a philosophy or a science. That's somebody's, you know, science fiction. You know, it's kind of like a science fiction. It's not rooted in anything. But if they're using their means of knowledge and the means of knowledge that we have, the valid means of knowledge that are there, and you go on inquiring, you learn a lot of things, but it's all within time and space. You can't can't totally get outside of time and space. It's kind of like an Archimedean point that can get out and look at it. We have something a little bit like that from the Vedantic perspective, is that because we can get outside of the dream, because we wake up from the dream, then we can look at the dream from outside of the dream. But the characters within the dream can't do that. It's because we get to wake up from the dream, we get to look at the dream, right, and talk about it and analyze it and everything. But the characters within the dream can't pop out of it. You know? We're like the Ishwara of the dream. So that knowledge of the dream is there for us from the dimension of the Ishwara of the dream, but not from the characters within the dream. Think like that in terms of the whole universe. But if you think of this whole universe kind of like that, there's an Archimedean point outside, you know, outside of the whole creation. Not for the ones who are within the creation. But that point from outside of the creation can really only be something that comes from knowledge that comes from Ishwara. It's called Aparusheya. It's not a man-made knowledge. The man-made knowledge, if it's knowledge, it depends upon your sense organs and the means of knowledge you have as a human being. And then all of the knowledge within the creation born of that, you know, has its own validity. I don't know if that helps. But. Okay. Can you repeat the difference between the five subtle and gross elements? Okay. When the creation comes into manifestation from its causal condition, we're saying that Maya comes into manifestation, and when it comes into manifestation, it comes into manifestation, the Sattva Maya, which is Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. That Maya means Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas come into manifestation in the form of the five subtle elements initially. And that means that each element is going to have a Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas aspect. Okay. Now, of those, so the five elements all have these three qualities, Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, the three gunas. The first two, the Sattva and Rajas, never go through any process of grossification. They are always subtle. They always remain as the Mahabhutas, the five subtle elements. The sattva aspect of the five elements, which will always be subtle, go in terms of the sukshma sharira, the subtle body. They make up the mind and sense organs. The rajas make up the rajas of the five subtle elements make up the pranas, the five pranas, and the five indriyas, karmendriyas, organs of action. And remember then, the total for the five subtle elements is the five sense organs. Be for the five sense organs and also the mind. So that's the sattva. So rajas, sattva, the mind and the sense organs. Rajas is the organs of action and the five pranas. And then we have the subtle tamas left. It is the subtle tamas that goes through the process of what we call panchikarana, becoming fivefold. And in that process of becoming fivefold, these five, each of the five subtle elements splits in half, and then the bottom half, say, just for the visual, the bottom half splits into fourths, which would be eighths in reference to the whole, fourths in reference to the bottom half, four parts. And so each one of those parts will then go to the other four elements. And so what you'll end up with is for each of the elements, it'll be half of its subtle self, like space, and an eighth of the other four. And that's called panchikaranam. And those elements are what we say make up the stula sharira, the gross or the physical world and body. So the physical world as Ishwara would be called virat, and the physical world for the jiva would be called vishwa. The subtle world, Hiranyagarbha, is Ishwara, means all the subtle elements, which it contains the rajas and tamas, you know. That's called Hiranyagarbha, and for the individual it's called Tejasa, the one self is shining. They're shining with consciousness. And then, so that's really the difference. When the elements are in causal condition, that's called the karana sharira. That would be called Ishvara from the total level and prajna from the subtle, from the level of the jiva. So basically, the difference between the elements that are grossified and the elements that are not in this physical gross world, the sattva and rajas aspect of the five subtle elements always remains subtle. But the tamas goes through this process of panchikarana, becoming fivefold to become the physical world. So that's the difference. The physical world is made up of, each element is 50% of itself, and then an eighth of all of the other four. And that's what's the difference between, like, subtle sukshma space and the sukshma and stula, the grossified space, is that it's gone through this process according to the kind of the, we call the vision of the Shastra. How can there be a memory of deep sleep when the citta is in causal condition? You want to say when the sattva, citta, is in causal condition, doesn't mean that it's still not sattva. The sattva is in causal condition, means it's not functioning, right? It's not active, it's just there. And so awareness is illumining that. And so that mind that then comes into the active, the awake condition, can then comment on what its condition was when it was non-functioning, when it was as though asleep. Do you have a remembrance of that sattva in that deep sleep condition? That's why. We went over that today. This question's from yesterday, I think, so maybe it's more clear now. Though I realize that that deep sleep is a repeating question. So. Is moksha, in technical terms, these two things? One, the ahankara shifting from the upadi to the atma. Two, understanding that the atma is Brahman. Is that it? When you gain knowledge, when you recognize that differentiation between yourself and the upadis. Remember now, upadi means a conditioning adjunct, and what that means is that you take an upadi to be yourself. That's what makes it an upadi. So you'll take the body to be the conscious being, to be me. You'll take the mind to be me. You'll take the sense organs to be me, like my eyes. These are my eyes. These are my ears. You know, in terms of a part of me. So that's the ajnanam that is removed with self-knowledge. Now, in that removal, when that ajnanam, that ignorance is there, then that identification, that very natural beginningless identification with these upadis, we call the ahankara. Because the ahankara is just simply my belief, my almost mithya jnanam, my false knowledge, my conviction that I am this body. Right? That's the ahankara, because the I, that is Brahman, is as though superimposed fully on this body, unbeknownst to me that there's any superimposition going on. I just say, I am this. If I say, I am this, that's the ahankara. If I say, I am happy or sad, that's the ahankara, because that identification has taken place because of ignorance. So when we say ahankara, it means I am this, I am thinking that. But we don't have to have the words. That's what you're doing. That's how you're feeling. You don't have to say, I am feeling like this, to be feeling like that. You still take it as you. So that misidentification born of ajnanam is called the ahankara. Ahankara means I'm as though giving an eye to this, I'm making this into me. Aham means I. Kara means I'm doing that. I'm doing that with the eye. I'm making it this. Just so I have a ahankara because I take myself to be this body, or I take myself to be the subtle body transmigrating, or I take myself to be the mind or the thoughts or feelings of the mind. That ahankara is natural. I don't have to label it. I just, everything I do is based on that. you know? Like even if in my language, if I say I'm taking a walk and I'm Agnani, I don't have self-knowledge, I really mean it. I'm taking a walk. You know, if I say I'm really tired, I mean I'm really tired. The self is tired, you know? So that's what we mean by ahankara. When one gains self-knowledge, then the ahankara becomes mitya. So you still might say, I'm taking a walk, but you don't mean really you're taking a walk. You're just talking like a normal person. Body's taking a walk, okay. Body's taking a walk. The mouth is eating. The nose is breathing. We're not going to do that, silly. But your sense of self is not the ahankara. Your sense of self is Brahman, you know. So you know who you are. And then from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, all of these activities are taking place. But from your own standpoint, you're the Satchitatma. You're always the same. In amidst all of this activity, you're always exactly the same. And that's aparoksha. You've recognized yourself. So it's not just an idea. It's a reality. So is moksha, in technical terms, the ahankara shifting from the upadhi to the atma? Yeah, the ahankara. The ahankara becomes mitya, and the your sense of self is the self. When you think of yourself, it's Brahman. Who you are is Brahman, is the self, and so that's the aham. Instead of a making of an I, you know, that superimposition, it's still there because the body and the sattva and all this is still here. So that sense of identification is there, but it's mitya because you know yourself very well, which is aparoksha, the one who's always the same. As all this activity is going on, you just remain exactly the same. So that viveka is there. Then, understanding that the atma is Brahman. Understanding, recognizing the fact of that, yeah. So really, moksha is called ajnana nivritti. It's the elimination of that ignorance that has caused you to take yourself to be the limited upadhi rather than recognizing yourself as Brahman, which is Ishvara. Rather than that understanding that it's not just intellectual, it's an actual recognition and an understanding also. It's the recognition, the aparoksha jnana, with also a plethora of logic to support it. Because you can say, well, why couldn't it be like this? And there are reasons why it really cannot be. Like what your imagination might be concocting. There's real reasons. And so that's why your questions are so important. Because these questions are what kind of root out the areas where there's not clarity. And that clarity keeps increasing, keeps flowering and flowering, you know. But it takes some time. So your questions and doubts are the things that you need to bring up, like what we're doing here. That's why satsang's so important, because it gives us a chance to really zero in on these questions, hopefully to point of clarity. The one thing, I mean, this is a good way to do it, I think, with these, asking these, with writing them down like this, but one thing that I used to find with Swamiji, when we would have satsang, we didn't know about this writing, we didn't do that, so it's just asking questions. I always found with Swamiji that I would ask a question, but he might not quite answer my question. He might not quite understand exactly what I meant. So then I would always have the opportunity then to say, after he would say what he thought, I said, Swamiji, that's not quite what I meant. Then I would reword the question, you know, like direct the question, because sometimes he would know exactly what I meant. Sometimes it would be, he would answer something that is quite what I was saying, but then I could always ask sometimes I would go one round or two rounds, and then I would get it, you know. Or if I didn't, then I was ready to ask it the next day, or the next day, until it was clear, and I could always direct the question. So when we do this like this, unless you're willing to raise up your hand and say, that's not quite what I meant, you know, which is fine to do, then you can direct your question more precisely. I can do my best to answer it, then you can say, well, but what about this? And we can push it, you know. So that's one thing I want you to feel some freedom to be able to do, because you'll see it just maybe if the answer isn't spot on, you can just say it a little different way. And then it has a better chance of being answered. Where's Sharda?
She took some rest.
She's okay?
Yeah, she's fine.
Okay, she was tired.
There's a lot that aren't here.
Tired, sick people.
Not feeling
well.
Yeah.
Yep. It's an emotional day.
Yeah. You have to be ready for emotional days. It's all part of it. Don't be afraid of it. We're stirring the pot really deeply. You know? So things come up, and we should all know that. So then we can all support each other and not freak out if somebody's having an emotional day or feeling uptight or whatever. Hundreds of ways we can feel. Mm-hmm. We're in deep now. Be ready. It's a good thing. Yeah. Just welcome it. Don't try to make it different. There's no reason. It's good to welcome it and process and deal with it. So you have this wonderful opportunity where you don't have to go to work or anything. You can be dysfunctional. It's good. Okay. Do we say a prayer?
Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmanevya Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Bharahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukha Bhak Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harih Om